been from.
So you actually graduated from high. Okay. This is Bruce Smith. This is August 5th, 2005. Interview with Jack Hall of Jacksonville, Florida, formerly of Cumberland, Kentucky. Uncle Jack, you were born in Harlan County. Tell us a little bit.
No, I was born in Letcher County.
Letcher County, but you grew up in Harlan County, correct?
No, I went to school in Letcher County until I was 17 years old, and my dad moved, and family moved to Cumberland in Harlan County, and I stayed with my grandmother because I was on the football team in Letcher, and I stayed over a couple of months. But I miss my family so much. I come into Cumberland then with my family. So I started going to school there and playing ball there, and that's where I was drafted from.
So you actually graduated from high school at Cumberland.
That's right.
Rather than Letcher County.
Cumberland, uh-huh.
That's just right over the mountain there.
Right across the mountain. That's right.
What was it like growing up in that part of Kentucky in that time?
Well, we was all so poor, nobody knew other than was poor. It was fun. We had the creeks was clear. I remember we used to fish in the Cumberland River there and catch big red eyes and bass, and you could see them floating in the, you could see them darting in the rocks. But you know, later on, the Lubert River, as we got older, I guess one time, about 17, I noticed the river being polluted and the fish being, the fish dying out, and it started polluting us pretty bad in there. It was nice growing up in there. We had a good childhood.
Even though those were sort of tough times.
Oh, they were tough. Everybody had a tough time, not just a few. They were all, in Letcher County, there's small mines around. It wasn't no big mines, but when we went to Harlan, you had International Harvest and the U.S. Steel over there. They paid big money, and so the things were a little different just across the mountain there. That's why Dad went there. He was a barber. He made a lot more money there than he did in Letcher County, so we moved over there.
Was there so his times were hard up there? As they always were, not just because it was the Depression.
Oh no, just well, nobody went hungry, but it was really, really hard time. Well, anyway, when I'm back in the 30s, the 35, 40s was pretty rough times.
Sort of describe it, you know, a typical day in high school there. I mean, just describe.
Oh man, and when I come to Cumberland, my dad got me a job at a service station after school, and I was playing football. I was king of the walk, more or less. There I fit right in with the crowds, and I found a little B model Ford Roadster, my A model, and it was pretty beat up. I bought it for $25, and then I ordered a top from Sears for $65, and I had a sharp little A-model roadster, the color that transformed into a B-model on account of a little difference in the motor, but I was king of the walk with that car.
Is that sort of where you developed some of your aptitude for mechanics and that sort of thing?
Well, more or less, I guess you can say that. I worked at a service station, then I had my car. It'd break down over a weekend somewhere, then I'd go work, call it in, work on it, and more or less that. And a service station, I also was fixing a truck flat one day, and bent over to check it, and the man, a truck tire, and the man was fixing it for it, hit it with a packet to see if it was on tight. The rim flew off, hit me across the mouth, knocked all my teeth out. Just a little more wear, and it decapitated me.
Yeah, that's true. That probably would have, wouldn't it? But it wasn't quite as funny at the time, was it?
No.
uh, When you graduated from high school, you were, what, 18 years old?
No. I graduated from high school April, May, I believe, wasn't it? I might have some of this wrong, but it's May. In June, I turned 18. I was drafted. And I said, well, maybe I'm getting confused here. I was 18. I turned 18 in June. And date of entry service was September of 43. This is in 43.
So you went directly from high school into the service?
Well, yeah, more or less. Graduated in June, no, September. I was out a couple of months, June, July, August, September, and I was drafted in September.
Now, was that fairly common for
young men? Yeah, back then, because I remember on the graduation day, we didn't want to go to graduation. About six of us that were going to the Army, Cumberland High School was on the hill. We were walking down through there, the principal hollering, come back, and shaking his hand, fist at us, and we laughed at him. We didn't, none of us go back. But we'd already graduated and more or less going through some stuff there, and we all never went back. Where is your call?
Okay. All right. You were talking about getting ready to go into the Army.
Yeah, then they drafted us and sent us to Camp Atterbury in Indiana. Indiana then took her these little tests to give us and found out I was pretty well qualified for automotive section and light ordnance control, fire control equipment. So they sent me to Santa Anita, California, where they had this type of training. And I was out there about 6 weeks. And then we come back after 6 weeks out there. And instead of going back to my company, the Army has a big pool where they put people in so they can reach in and get them. In the meantime, there's a company from Missouri, the 281st Ordnance Maintenance Company, been in training for about 5 years, Home Guard or National Guard. They've been training for 5 years. Here I've been in the Army for about two months. Going overseas the next morning, the man got sick. And you know who the man was? I had his MOS number. So they reach up there and get me. Been in the Army 6 months, I guess. And I had to take his place, run, get my gear, hit the ship, hit England then next 3 or 4 days.
Okay, when you say MOS number, what does that stand for?
That's your number they assign to you, what you're qualified to do. One is mechanic, that's got a number, and one's an artillery man, one's a tank man, whatever the number they give you.
And so you shipped out for England then, were you?
Next day, to come back. Hadn't been in 3 months or four. I don't remember.
So what year was that? That was.
I was in 43.
43. Do you have?
Because I was still 18. We come into England. I believe we got it in Liverpool. Went across to England to a little town called Nantwich, and got all of our equipment cleaned up, and got it ready, and in fact, I fell in love with a girl in that
way.
We'd stand in guard, and she'd bring us crumpet and teas out there. Those English gals were great. Anyway,
did you have any?
We left, and I never got to tell her goodbye. She, I never seen her again, never did write to her, because I knew too far to count a romance anyway.
When you were shipping over there in transit, did you have any sleepless nights worrying about the U-boat menace in the Atlantic?
Oh, God, yeah. We went over on the Louis Pasteur. It's a big old French ship. And they was feeding us beans and more, and there was more puke on that boat than every soldier in there was puking. Yeah, we was all sick. We were young, most of us, and sick. I never really worried too much. I always, all my life, except whatever come, but some of those boys were crying and going on, and We were all sick, though. When we went to England, we all got in pretty good spirit because those English people treated us great. And just like I said, that I didn't even, we didn't, we had come in the orders, say we were going down to load up. I forgot where we went to. We went somewhere and loaded up. I don't remember the ship, name of the ship anyway. We had to go in a tide with it. So we loaded up. We didn't even tell anybody. I said, you're leaving, and I don't, nobody know we're leaving. So pack your gear, and we got, and we loaded up on a boat one night, and we crossed the channel, and man, that's the awfulest storm I ever saw. We thought we was going to drown, all of us. The waves were shooting so high. I believe that's, I believe that might be in your history book, too. Anyway, I can recall that, because, man, that's one time we were scared. And the next morning, we got up and looked, went on deck and looked down. Well, we were on deck, most of us. We looked out, and the sun come up. As far as you could see that way, looked like the earth was turning, and this way and behind you, ships.
Okay, now you've moved on to the D-Day invasion now, right?
All right, right. We're down to D-Day invasion. Okay. And as far as you could see that way and this way were ships. And we'd hear the shooting and the bombing and the boys going in. Those were the boys called hell. And I thank God that I wasn't in that first wave. But that next morning, I believe it was the next morning now. I'm no hero. And I didn't try to. Next morning, we went in. It could have been up in the day. We had to go in with a tide.
Right.
Because the boys went in, they went in with their tanks and with their boats and the infantry, but we had to go in with the tide. I climbed down a ladder, a rope ladder, and I fell in. It wasn't too deep, I guess, on the ground. It's all that equipment on. Then we got our trucks down and loaded up and took off to France. Hit France, man, people are handing us wine and flowers. And we went on through France, then into the, down to the, we shot on down into below, without any trouble. We all know we hit the hedgerows in France, we had some trouble.
Can we go back to England for just, how long were you in England prior to your embarkation?
It wasn't too long. I don't even remember how long. I often wondered that myself, how long was there. Mm-hmm. Because I know I sure did enjoy that little stay in England. But,
were you locked down immediately prior to the invasion commencing?
Oh, yeah. Nobody allowed to leave. Nobody said anything.
For how long did that go on? I mean, was that like a week? Was that
2 days? No, it wasn't going but a day or two. We were ready. They were gathering. And, because we had to get to and load up on a ship, and
so were you under Patton's command at that time?
No.
Because Patton was up north with that fictitious First Army group.
That's right. No, that's one thing that's been void in my life. I can't remember. I thought I'd look at it and try to find out what army I was in then. Originally, it was a 521st. Ordnance maintenance company. We went in when we got to France, down in France there, but I like to go back to the hedgerows when we got in there. We wasn't fighting now. I'm no hero or nothing. Wasn't trying, but we were close enough through these boys. We kind of tried to keep stuff prepared. We would go in and set up, run behind them, or clean that, look, check out a town, see if it's clean, go we get to them. But when they hit the hedgerows of France, our little tanks, I think, were Shermans. And those tanks were small. And they would hit them hedgerows and just buck right up. And they'd take them 88s and just blow them all to pieces. And machine guns, these all machine guns, those hedges. And one day, I don't know how it happened now. This is a long time ago. I was over there and was watching come up. We were preparing some tanks for one of our departments. And this old boy had a tank in there, and he had some big old iron pieces. He was welding on the front of that tank and looked like saw blades. It wasn't stationary because They didn't have no way to make them. They had to make them stationary. So he put that on there. Then when it hit that hedgerow, they'd cut the roots out and shoot right through it. Before, they'd rise up on it, and I don't care how heavy that tank was, they couldn't get over. But when they put that on them tanks and hit that, that just cut them roots, and they went right on through it.
And you were there when?
Yeah, and later on, I thought that amazed me. I often wondered who done it. I guess some old country boy first thought of it. But later on, as they got bigger tanks and things, I seen some nice big blades on them that they made. These just made out of old metal wood.
So yeah. So your responsibility was part of keeping tanks and other mechanized.
Well, no, that was the other section. I had nothing to do with that. Mine was to repair generators that run the remote controls and the lights and everything. They were small. Well, they were on a big truck, but I more or less repaired them because I started to, and that's what saved my life, I guess, because later on I'll tell you about that. We run on through France there and didn't have no problems at all. I did get this map out of the railroad station I was showing you. And that sword on a wall, we went out there, were shooting, they were shelling us, I guess, radiates. They shoot them like a rifle. And we run into this train station and bombed out. And when they quit bombing, I looked up, and here lives this sword over top of this map. It's a linen type map, it's made out of paper. And I took it down and folded it up and put it in my duffel bag. And I brought to carry the old sword a long time. And then we got down into the other side of Paris, we were 14 miles on the other side of Paris, and they let us go on so the De Gaulle and his bunch could come parading through there. And in the meantime, I had a little conflict with the company commander there. I was on guard one night, and he come out to get a Jeep, and I wouldn't let him have it on account of he didn't have a pass. And he tell me he's going to take it. Anyway, I wouldn't let him have the Jeep, and the next morning we went down. They said he wanted to see me at the office as soon as I had breakfast. And they was all laughing around there about it, and I didn't get it. Anyway, I still don't know what it's about. They were talking about me stopping them. Anyway, as I got breakfast done and come back to the company, they said, pack your gear. Something's happened up in Luxembourg, up and up the way. So, man, we all throwed it in, and that's when Patton took over. Oh, God and butts. We run day and night, mud. I remember the mud, my God, the mud. And okay, the weather and cold.
Moved on to the Battle of the Bulge now, haven't we?
Huh?
We're talking about Patton's relief of Bastogne.
Yeah, this is we heading up in Luxembourg up into Bastogne. We got into the Ardennes, run out of gas. And I don't know if those black boys ever got enough credit for what they done. They had what they call a Red Ball Express. Them fellows run gas. Them big trucks, day and night. You could hear them going and going and passing. And we'd have to lay back for them a little bit. We got in there and had to dig in. It snowed and it was cold, and we dug in, and all this dug in pretty deep. And we stayed right in there for, I don't know, maybe, I don't know how long. I just forgot it's been so long. And then, in the meantime, Hitler had massed this bunch of tanks up there in Bastogne. And they were breaking through, and they were coming right at us. And they started taking the cooks, and anybody wasn't any use to them at all. In fact, they'd come to get me, the captain sent, and my sergeant told him no, said that he absolutely couldn't finish the work there if he took me. So that probably saved my life. What the younger boys and some of them they did take up there, I never did see them again, I never did hear. I tried to contact them. But in the meantime, Bastogne, the Germans were shoving pretty hard to coming through at us, and the planes were circling above because we was all fogged in. Mm-hmm. And I understand, I don't know this for a fact, that they kept these planes up there with supplies all the time. We were there 6-7 days, and he just about broke through and come through. One morning we got up and we see a shadow on a snowbank, and everybody started hollering. In the meantime, the supplies started falling in. Then that gave us what we need, and that's what saved Bastogne.
So Bastogne was at, you know, was a pretty desperate situation, wasn't it? I mean, it was.
Oh, it was very desperate. In fact, if they hadn't got those supplies in there, we'd none of us have been here today, probably. No, he'd massed a big, all of his big tanks, and the big tanks up there. I think they were Tiger tanks. I don't know. And they were coming through, and then it was desperate. They were using their, like I say, cooks, their young, everybody. They were stripping us. And first, second round, I guess the third round, we'd all had been up there to try to stop. If the sun hadn't come up, they said, the hell with repairs work, let's get up and stop this. But that sun come out, and then planes started dropping those supplies. And we got our supplies and saved our life.
The Sherman really wasn't any match for the German, any of the Germans.
Oh, no. Not later, we got bigger tanks. No, that little Sherman looked like a little kitty car. Nah, that's it. As far as.
Well, I mean, when. Since you were there for the whole. You know, the historians talk about the Falaise Gap. You know what I'm talking about, where Bradley and. Montgomery were real close, you know, like 60 miles from each other, and all they had to do was converge on each other to bag just about the entire German army, but they let them slip out of that gap.
I don't know about them, man. I don't read much reading about it. That's just my little bit of experience there, just what little part I played in. I can remember that. I remember old Patton running us day and night. I mean, and in fact, I saw a show here a while back, and they said want to know if they were talking to some generals, said is anybody here can get these troops up there?
Oh, they're talking.
Get the troops up there. Oh, I first realized they had these generals around, and somebody. One of the higher ranking generals asked if a man could get it, move his troops. How long it taken to move it up there? And I think Patton, some of them said it was this, and some of them said that. And Patton said he'd be there 2 or 3 days, and they said, no way you can do it. And that's what I think he said. But anyway, whatever he said, he done it. We moved day and night, getting up in the Ardennes and up there in position.
Well, what was your most terrifying experience of the war?
Those 88s, I mean, that's about it. We was four back then. I didn't have any really terrifying experience except what bombing we had. We'd go through it. When we'd go in, we'd look for a place that we would set up our equipment back and behind concrete walls and so forth. That's how I found this other sword. This sword with lion heads and the spurs is a cavalry sword. In fact, it looked like it just come out of the store. We were going through this little town and to set up our equipment, and we went through to see if just check around, see if any German left, because some of them usually linger and get into civilian clothes. And I went in this old beautiful big bombed out house there. I thought maybe we'd set up three generators or something in that walls there. And there on a big, beautiful desk lay this cavalry sword with ruby eyes and a set of spurs on it, complete. And the desk, and I thought, well, this don't look right. I looked around, I didn't see anybody. And I finally got behind a door or behind something and took me a big, long stick and raked it off. Afraid it's booby trap. So I picked it up, these two swords I sent home. And
I think at some point did you ever encounter any of the concentration camps there?
Oh yeah, we got into a little place in Germany there, and they we were working there, and one of the sergeants, captains, had been out seeing how far we were away from how far we were from our supply depot or something. He come back and says, "Gather all the men you can. Let's go down here." We went into a little German town there, and went up on a rise, and there were corpses stacked about as high as this house, about twice as high as this room, about as wide as a football field, about as long as a football field, stacked up like cordwood. And some of them were already in the ditch, and some of their hands were still moving. It was slave labor, and they had bulldozers were shoving them in. In fact, this field is still full of dirt and humans. And they were shoving them in, trying to cover them up before we get there. Then they had a guardhouse down here where they had poles hung up where they'd hang them up, let dogs tear their testicles out. And then there's a lot of those, they took the rifle butts and crushed those heads in it, was helping them there, trying to kill everybody before we got in there. Oh, yeah. I still smell that sometimes, that stench.
So you actually saw, these were the Germans pushing them in there with bulldozers, or were...
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And
slave labor.
Okay.
Jews, yeah. They were, what they were trying to do, they were trying to cover them up. And in the meantime, we went down and helped them gather up all the civilians and the burgomaster, or they call them mayor, and come up in their fine clothes, and we made them pick a bunch of them up or laying outside and bury them. But we couldn't stay there too long. But there's women and all of them, old German people crying and going on. But that's the most horrible sight. I never will forget them. Then we got another little town there. And I never was too gung-ho about it. But we got checking out before we set up. And a little boy could run down to one of our, little Polish boy run down to one of our people there and says that the German soldier up here says he cut my finger off, two fingers, that I reached for a piece of bread and he cut the meat cleaver, and he took him and showed him to him, and the couple of fellows grabbed him and took him down to a boxcar, and this kid followed him. They give the throw the shell of 48 and handed this kid, and he blowed his head off. I stood out. I didn't take no part in it. I could curl lessons. It's like we were always would come by, or the infantry was loading up a bunch of German soldiers one day, and they wouldn't leave them. They wouldn't leave them no watches, knives. I mean, no, of course not knives. Coins, anything they might be able to use. And we started helping them, and they told us what to do. So take all their, when you take a watch, you throw them in a pile over there. We just strip them off. One of them was, it looked like it was an officer, and boy, he didn't like it. He tried to buck me, and I just shoved the back of the rifle, and I threw it. I thought, I'll throw that one aside. And after it was over, we shot them, most of them up, but I was careful not to shoot that one. It was an Omega, a beautiful watch, and I opened the back of it. It was this Grand Prix Paris 1900. I brought it back home, and I gave it to Gary, and you can wind it up down here. Thing is beautiful watch. Then I took a couple of them. Thank you.